Don't cry out loud.
What? Oh my God. What the hell was
that? I really don't know. That's a new one. That's a new one even for me.
Man.
Apparently I was rolling on my
well, that's good.
Video.
Now we can
for all
of
that. So I'm just going to save that as a bonus.
Hey everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl.
Oh, hello. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, our weekly podcast about tech, the economy, and culture, where none of us is as smart as all of us. That all happened from memory today, guys, because we have torn up the script.
We have torn it up. That's true.
We've torn it up. It's so it's actually pretty exciting. I mean, it's sort of an accident. It wasn't a plan.
Shh, don't tell anybody.
But as it happens, when on a day when we were set to talk to an economist,
yeah,
and some big economy things have occurred, our guest is otherwise engaged, which leaves us alone to talk about the economy, which actually I think is awesome, and I'm pretty excited about it. Think of it as one giant news fix today.
That is true. That is true. Mm-hmm. And here's why we're doing what we did. So this morning, there I am driving to work, and over the radio comes, meanwhile, the Federal Reserve has cut its interest rates 0.5 percentage point this morning. And I went, what? So what the Fed did this morning was what's called an emergency rate cut. It's between meeting cycles. They weren't supposed to meet until the 18th and 19th of this month. But they looked around at the coronavirus and apparently said, oh, my God. And so they came out with a 0.5 percentage point cut in the what's called the federal funds rate, which is the rate the Federal Reserve controls. It is the first time the Fed has made an intermeeting cut since the financial crisis. It's their first 0.5 percentage point cut since the financial crisis. Let me say here parenthetically, this is not the financial crisis, but it is a very big deal. And that's why we're going to talk about it.
It is a big deal. It's such a big deal that even I watched the press conference this morning.
Wow.
With Fed Chair Jay Powell.
Wow, wow, wow.
Yeah. And it was as my kid was sort of on his way out to the, it was a wonderful learning moment. We had this whole, like, we talked about interest rates and how they work and when you cut them and how many points it is. And then we wow. watched the little ticker on the CNBC screen go from green to deep red
yeah.
as during the course of the chairman's remarks.
Yeah.
And he said, how many points is that? And things like, and I was like, look
wow.
at you. You're just
good
ready to start listening to Marketplace.
That's awesome. Sign them up.
Yeah, it was a big deal. And I think it's kind of this weird, I actually feel like the oddness of it in some ways was summed up by this phrase that I heard on another national public radio program where they introduced the story as by saying Fed Chairman Jay Powell basically like makes a big move against coronavirus. Like something
yeah.
to the extent that was, it's sort of just like, yeah, so it turns out monetary policy and global outbreak of virus are like tricky bed partners here.
Yeah, this is a really interesting cut, and I'll give you the 90-second disquisition, and then we can start talking about it. So I think we all started realizing this was going to get really serious a couple of weeks ago when Apple on that Monday came out and said, look, we are going to miss our revenue targets because we can't get the goods that we need from our manufacturing base in China, which is largely shut down because of the coronavirus. Everybody went, oh my God, what we're looking at here is what's called a supply shock. That is to say, it's the supply of goods that is impacting the macroeconomic forecast, as opposed to what is usually the case where it's a demand shock. That is to say, consumers and their desire to purchase goods goes away. So what we have now is the world's factory, right, China, just now getting out of it, and we're dealing with still a supply shock. The challenge, of course, is that when it's a supply shock, when you don't have enough goods coming to market, lower interest rates isn't necessarily going to fix that. I think what the Fed got worried about this morning and has been worried about for a week or two probably is the idea that this is going to turn into a demand shock because people aren't going to go to restaurants and people aren't going to buy airplane tickets. You see conferences getting canceled already. You see soccer games being played in front of empty stadiums in Italy, right? And that then turns into a supply shock and the Fed is saying, okay, so look, we're going to have companies who are dealing with some debt, who are going to have increasing debt because they're not going to be able to sell enough of whatever it is that they make. And we're going to make it a little bit easier for them, a little bit cheaper for them to pay their debts. And that, I think, is what the Fed is doing today. The challenge, of course,
right.
is the timing of all this and the signal it sends because, and I'll be done in a sec, the challenge, of course, is the signal, right? Because everybody looks at the Fed and everything's fine and la, 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 la. And then at 7 o'clock this morning, LA time, oh my God, the Fed thinks it's really bad. Is it really bad? I don't know. It could be good. I don't know. Let's buy. Let's sell. Let's not. Let's buy. And the markets just went bananas. And now they're down because clearly everybody thinks the Fed knows something that we don't know. And it's going to get really bad. And that's why people are worried.
Yeah. I want to talk about the timing because this has been the real question. It, you know, obviously you had President Trump on Twitter, kind of like he always does, saying the Fed needs to cut rates and that will fix everything. And he was asked a question, of course, about independence and whether it was a response to pressure. But look, like, if you do it now, and we already know that there just aren't that many arrows in the quiver anyway,
right?
What room is there if this thing gets materially worse?
Okay. So there's a couple of things going on there, and we'll get to the materially worse thing in a minute. First of all, the president and the Fed, don't get me started. Number one. Number two, the timing of this thing.
Can't I, though? Because now I kind of want to.
All right, we can in a minute, but let me get through this first.
Timing.
The timing of this thing. So last week, as we know, was terrible in the markets. They basically had a hissy fit, and everybody started thinking about a Fed rate cut. And the Fed, in fact, on Friday, Powell came out with a statement that said, we will do whatever we have to do to keep the economy solid. And then yesterday happens, and the markets are up, and everything's fine. And then today they come out on a kind of middling day and say, well, now is when we're going to do it, when there have not been any economic effects seen yet. So what is happening is that the Fed is now seen as being played by a very, very obstreperous market device, right? And the market had a tantrum and the Fed said, oh my goodness, now we have to calm the markets down. And look, there's some merit to the markets being calm, but really the idea that the Dow can fall from 29 to 25 and or 27-ish and the Fed goes, ooh, you know, here, I'll take care of you. Don't worry about it. It's going to be okay, is bananas, because that's not the way it's supposed to work, right? The Fed is supposed to worry about underlying economic conditions. And so far, as Powell said this morning in a statement, the underlying economic conditions are fine. What it's going to be like in 6 weeks, don't know.
Right. That's why I think the timing is so interesting. And that's why I think this question of independence really does need to be. Because look, you had plenty of traders saying, yes, it is a bummer to wipe out a year's worth of gains in five trading days. But many of them still felt that the market in some places was overvalued and had room to fall. And so, yeah, like treating the market like a toddler having a temper tantrum, as you sort of seem to lay it out there, that is a Trumpian response
to
protect the markets.
It absolutely is. And look, I think people have been saying this for a very long time. Now, I'm not the only one, and I'm certainly not the first. But it's kind of problematical when the Fed reacts to day-to-day market moves, even of the scale that we saw last week, and the underlying economic conditions are still fine. Now, can they change in a hurry? Yes, they can. Is the Fed trying to get ahead of the power curve? Certainly. But an intermediate rate cut of 50 basis points, half percentage point, is a big, big deal. And I'm not sure that they thought through how this was going to appear. That's my two cents.
What happens?
Oh, right.
I mean.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, now,
what happens if it gets way worse?
Right,
like, I am certainly in the camp of there is going to be massive economic fallout as a result of this virus spreading, if only because people are going to stay home. Like you said, they're not going to shop. There's supply shock, which we have not even started to feel. Like a huge benchmark for a lot of people is the LA port, which is basically
like empty. Yeah.
Right? They're showing pictures of empty berths, like container ships aren't coming in. Then there's the potential like 25% hospitalization rate. Like this is how you all get to like economic gears grinding to a halt. Right. What do we do if there are no other arrows left in the quiver?
Right. So that's the challenge now, right? The main interest rate the Federal Reserve controls is now set at a range of 1.0 to 1.25%. That's the federal funds rate. So it can really only go just a teensy bit lower. And let's remember during the recovery from the financial crisis, it was at zero for fundamentally a decade. That is to say, the zero lower bound, you can go below zero, but let's not even get into negative interest rates because that's a whole different deal. But fundamentally, the Fed doesn't have too many arrows left in its quiver. So the other thing that we're thinking about is, well, look, what can we do in fiscal policy, which is to say the power of the government to tax and spend, right? You got fiscal policy, taxing and spending. You got monetary policy run by the Fed, which is interest rates. The challenge, of course, is that we are now running $1 trillion deficits. And remember, deficits are the annual number. So each and every fiscal year, we are spending $1 trillion more thanks in part to government spending under President Trump, thanks in part to the tax cuts under President Trump, and thanks in part to inertial momentum in the way the government works, right? $1 trillion more a year until the end of this decade, which is bananas. So, and look, borrowing is cheap, and in the long run, you know, we're going to be able to figure this out because we control our own currency. But $1 trillion deficit is a really daunting prospect when you're thinking about adding more fiscal stimulus, taxing and spending stimulus to the economy, right? They, Congress mm-hmm. could do tax cuts. They could do bonus. They could give everybody a $1,000 check and take a page from Andrew Yang's playbook, right? There's only so much room in each of these quivers, and I frankly don't know what we do next. Yes, there's quantitative right. easing. Don't at me on that one. I don't even want to get into that.
I kind of don't either because
okay.
that is weirdly, that's a set of words that puts yeah. me right to sleep.
Yeah.
I do want to bring up one other thing in the spending
yes.
department, which is a breaking news alert that I just got
before
we started this program,
yes.
which is that the Trump administration is now considering paying hospitals for treating uninsured coronavirus patients.
Well, yeah. I mean, so the idea that like in South Korea and Japan, all this testing is free and here it costs mm-hmm. thousands of dollars to get tested is bananas.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Without question,
yeah.
right? And it, without question, is going to keep people home and yep. keep them from getting yep. tested. And I'm certain that some Democratic candidates are going to have a field day mm-hmm. with the idea that universally covering people might be possible and mm-hmm. useful. What is interesting, though, is that the administration is considering using a national disaster program hmm. to pay for it. And we just had tornadoes kill 19 mm-hmm. people, I think, in Tennessee. You do start to wonder, because of the $1 trillion debt, where all the money is coming from. And you kind of mentioned in passing, we control our own currency, but like, really?
Well, what do you mean?
I don't know. How much should I worry about this?
Well, so look, if nobody asks President Trump where he's getting the $750 billion that he's going to spend on the Pentagon this year, right? $750-$760 billion. Nobody says, Mr. President, how are you going to pay for that? I think it's kind of silly to ask, how are you going to pay for universal health insurance? I mean, it's not politically just, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to borrow the money, right?
Right.
We're going to borrow the money.
I mean, fundamentally, should we be borrowing the money not necessarily to pay for rate cuts, but to invest quickly and heavily in public health initiatives?
Oh, sure. Look, thanks in no small part to the Federal Reserve this morning, money in this economy is essentially free, right? The federal government can issue a 10-year note now for something like 1%, right? Mm-hmm. Which is bupkis. It's nothing.
I mean,
money is free.
The only stocks up today, near as I could tell, at least right after the Fed announcement, were real estate.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, home builders and all that. Right.
Real estate related.
Right.
Home builders,
look,
all of that.
Look, if you're in the market for a mortgage or you want to refi, today.
Yep.
Today.
That is literally the one upside. You know, are you familiar with the old saying, when there's blood in the streets, buy property?
Yes, I am.
Today's the
day.
Yes,
I is.
Today is the day. But yeah, I guess now we find out. And that's what I found so interesting about that statement. Like the Fed takes a big, you know, crack at coronavirus or tries to fight coronavirus. Like the idea of fighting a global epidemic with monetary policy, that's clearly part of it. But I guess we're going to find out if that's even...
Yeah.
And
look, Powell said today in his statement, monetary policy will not cure this virus.
Right? Right.
But what we can do is maybe ease the hard landing. So we'll see what happens. I don't know.
A friend of mine described it as something like a home equity line of credit. You don't necessarily need it, but it's good to have.
That's not bad.
Is how he interpreted the rate cut.
I'd go with that.
Yeah. I was like, okay, that's fine. But I think as Kai has been nicely warning you all week, just don't.
Do not look at your 401k.
Don't over-rotate on the 401k. Yeah. Exactly. Just not worth it.
Yeah. So there we go.
That's
my 2 cents.
All right.
All right.
Okay, great.
Moving on.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
All right, we're back, but we're not really back because we got to do a thing first before we get to the rest of the news of the day. If you're watching on YouTube, Molly's probably wearing the shirt, right? You're a shirt wearer.
I'm wearing the shirt.
I'm not a shirt wearer.
You are not a shirt wearer.
No,
at all.
So look, here's the deal. It is a mini spring giving drive this week at Marketplace. Super deal for you on this. Wait for it, Super Tuesday. $30. Donate $30 and get our new Marketplace T-shirt in your choice of. Fitted or fitted V, I'm told, or relaxed crew neck. Mm-hmm. I'll hold it up here.
I'm wearing the fitted V. Oh, I'm wearing the fitted V. He's
so
holding it up. I'm gonna show you. Because on the back it has
the
pun.
Back. Get the pun it? Says, I'm invested in Marketplace.
Invested
you probably can't see that in
Marketplace.
The
oh, we'll you know, see. It's actually, it's a lovely shirt. It's fitted, but it's not too fitted. It won't make you feel like muffin toppy. It's real nice. I'm wearing it. These are important considerations.
They are.
$30 is all you have to donate to get this T-shirt, and it's a nice, heavy cotton. Like, you're definitely going to feel like you got your $30 worth, in addition, of course,
yes,
to supporting high-quality, non-sensational, not hysterical, good journalism.
We try. Marketplace.org/donate is where you should go for this. And here's the deal. You get more than just a T-shirt when you become a Marketplace investor, right? You get the satisfaction of knowing that you are helping us in doing what we do, which is on this program, making people smarter on Marketplace writ large. It's raising people's economic intelligence, whether it's technology or what have you. It is a thing we all need more than ever, especially in this election year. Marketplace.org/donate.
Please do.
Please.
If you have never donated before, it's a great opportunity. We're trying to get to 500 donors. Did you just say that?
I didn't, but we
it
are.
Is a limited... Yes, we are by next week, by the way. 500 new donors.
No rush.
Like, no pressure. No rush. So go. The T-shirt is a limited time deal, and we're really just trying to, like, set these short-term goals and by God, crush them.
Please do it.
So one more time, marketplace.org/donate, and thank you.
All right, so I'm going to go first on News Fix today. You ready? Because I love this
Go
one.
For it.
Okay. The National Basketball Association has come out and said that instead of high fives, players should do fist bumps because of coronavirus.
You're still, like, I don't know. You're still
what?
Touching somebody's hand.
The CDC did some work, and apparently the deal is that
knuckling. A fist bump is okay.
Fist bumping is like 25, some huge percentage less of germ transmission than shaking hands or high fives. And let me just tell you that when I was refereeing a bunch of 12-year-olds playing soccer this weekend, and they all came around after the game to shake the referee's hand, I was like, knuckle me, yo. Knuckles. We're just doing knuckles. Yeah. So.
I guess that's a way to... Wow.
Yeah.
What is the difference between a knuckle and a high five? Is it literally just like
high
that
five
all the
is
bad
the open
stuff
palm,
is on the palms?
Right? And you get your palm, and then you scratch your eye, or you pick your nose, but you're not putting your knuckle up your nose, right? Yes, I did just say that.
Now we're going to get emails from, like, it's going to be pictures of toddlers with the knuckles up the nose and the, you know, everything's, that's where you rub your eye with your knuckles.
Well, you
I don't
do,
know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Okay, we'll see. If everybody starts fist bumping, though, out of the way. There was some I saw today. This is like a mini news fix before I even get to the main one. But there was something today to the effect that, like, employees at tech companies have proposed a hackathon. A coronavirus hackathon where they can try to come up with possible solutions related to coronavirus, including moving from a handshake or a fist bump to like an elbow bump. This is what the greatest minds in Silicon Valley are up to right now.
Wow. Look, you know, if that's what it takes to get this thing fixed.
Is figuring out. Where do you stand? So my news fix is actually a way to get into a question that I have. But so the news part is that now, so Twitter yesterday... on Monday, announced that it was going to pull out of South by Southwest in Austin. Then Facebook announced the same thing by the end of the evening. So Facebook and Twitter are now out. Interestingly, that it seemed to take a long time for these companies to make that decision Facebook canceling its own. And I think that there are some interesting Pacific Rim politics at play there. Like, maybe they assumed for various reasons that the Bay Area is a greater threat than Austin, Texas, and now have been somewhat slow to realize, like, oh, this thing is national and international. Yeah. South by Southwest, the organizers have been, like, real stubborn about not canceling this thing, which I think is very interesting. But that leads to my sort of general question, which is, like, how do we feel about all these companies and their pretty varying policies on travel? Like, some are saying it's up to your – I've been having this conversation with all of my friends lately. Some are saying we're restricting domestic travel. You have to get special approval for it.
Yeah.
Same with international. Others are saying it's kind of up to you. We would never make you travel if you didn't feel comfortable, but – we're not necessarily banning it. And I am of two minds about it. There's a part of me that thinks, like, companies should make it easier on their employees. Like, you don't want to be the person who says, I have an elderly parent at home, so I'm worried about travel. I can't go on this business trip, but then get sort of subtly punished for it.
Yes, that is a very good point and totally fair. And I don't know the answer because, I mean, one would hope that everybody would follow the CDC's guidelines, right? And let's assume that the CDC's guidelines are free of political interference, which, you know, I'll just leave that hanging there. come on, these are interesting times, right?
They are.
But one would hope that companies would follow CDC's guidance. But, you know, they're private corporations and they can do what they want.
No, they totally are. I just think it's interesting. I think we're starting to see a lot of different responses and we're going to see a lot of other different ones. And that's just one that we've been talking about a lot. Yeah. That is it for the news fix for now. If you want more from us, I mean, that and, of course, everything that we did at the top of the show. But if you would like to hear more from us, tell your smart speaker to make me smart for a fresh new explainer every day. There are some good ones again this week.
All right, time for the mailbag.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
They're all on the same topic right now, let's be real. Last week's show was about pandemics, just like this week's show, and COVID-19 specifically. We also talked a little bit about macroeconomic impacts, just like today. Listener Andy Izazi wrote in with a microeconomic question, and he writes, I have been wanting to know more about what constitutes price gouging. A friend of mine has been trying to find masks for immunocompromised family members to better prepare for a possible COVID-19 outbreak. Almost everywhere was sold out, but she did manage to find some at a 250% markup. Where do we draw the line between scarcity pricing and outright price gouging? Do we? Is there a line? Is there regulation?
There are some lines. It depends on where you live, right? Some states have price gouging laws, right? Some don't.
California does.
It's very much dependent. It's very much dependent. But I'll tell you what, we're going to put a map of the states with anti-price gouging laws on our show page, and you can check it out there. Because that stinks, you know?
Generally speaking, at least in California, and it sounds like it's similar elsewhere, they prohibit raising the price of many consumer goods and services by more than 10% after an emergency has been declared. So if this guy is selling, you know, masks at 250% markup in the Northeast or Southeast or California, there are calls that can be made to the state's attorney general office. Not the same with other states, but also, more importantly, I think, like, the question of e-commerce complicates all of this. Because a lot of this is also happening on Amazon, which is something we're going to cover on the tech show. But it's
It is.
I'm going to just say, come on, clearly is.
All right. Week before last, we did a show on housing, as you might remember. Huge amount of feedback on that one because it's an issue that affects everybody. A lot of you wrote in to say that you live in a small city or a rural place. Plenty of cheap housing out there. Not enough jobs, though. Here is Jean Storsberg with her take on that part of it.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Jean. Longtime listener, first time caller inner. I really enjoyed your conversation about housing the other week and the focus on getting more housing. But I was wondering why there's so much focus on building more housing in the four or five cities in the United States where the jobs are and not getting the employers to bring the jobs to where housing is cheaper. For example, setting up a big headquarters in the Camden, New Jerseys or Detroit, Michigans of the world. I really appreciate your input. Thanks so much for doing the show.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of chicken and egg, right? It's our company's going to like make the investment to put a large office park in Camden, New Jersey, or a huge factory or what have you, and then just like hope that people are going to come. Or are they going to go to the population centers, which accrete over time more people, and then invest there? And I think that is definitely the challenge. And look, you see, it's not just here, right? You see it happening in China for sure with those mega cities like Chongqing and Shanghai and Wuhan, which has been in the news, right? 11-something million people, because that's where the factories are. And that is, I think, the investment challenge that companies have to make. For sure.
Right. And then once they start to, I was just actually in Pittsburgh talking about trying to build a tech economy in Pittsburgh. And once you're trying to build this economy and then you have this tension, you're trying to convince people to move there. And your lever in a lot of cases is you could buy a house here.
Mm-hmm.
But you're a company who might be, you need talent and you can't always pay a moving cost. And then there becomes the question of equity in the community. Can you do skills transfer to the people who already live there and get them to a point where they can be a talent base? But all of that takes investment. And so for some companies, they say like it's like buying a house in the expensive neighborhood with all the good schools. Like you pay more because then you have to pay for private school.
Right. Exactly.
Anyway, chicken egg. The shorter version of that is what Kai said.
Right.
On that episode, we also talked about YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard, that movement, this coalition of people who want to promote the development of more housing. Not all of you agree with that approach. Not surprisingly, here's listener Tracy Rosenthal with her take.
Hi, Kai. Hi, Molly. This is Tracy from Los Angeles. I listen to you all the time. Yay. And I was really disappointed with your last show because it portrayed YIMBY as the only reasonable solution to the housing crisis. The YIMBYs completely ignore the problems of corporate consolidation and absentee ownership. Properties in Midtown Manhattan are now vacant because they're being used as investments, not as homes. What all this suggests is that it matters very much what kind of housing gets built and that the problem is one of distribution and not production. It's very Econ 101 to say the housing problem is one of supply and demand, but where's our 201 understanding of multiple housing markets, top, middle, bottom, and of speculation on land prices, which we know doesn't act like other commodities?
Because they ain't making no more land. So, look, that's interesting, right? But if we can't, even out here in California, right, where we tend blue, it's fair to say, right? If we can't pass something like the housing bill that we talked about with Connor Daugherty, what chance is there to regulate housing markets anywhere else in this economy, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I would say you have to have, like, part of the reason that properties in Midtown Manhattan are vacant because they're being used as investments, not as homes, is because the market is fundamentally broken. Those houses can be used as investments because they're worth too much, because there's not enough housing.
Yeah.
Like, no matter what, you can move on to 201, but you always have to start with 101. And like, we need to build more houses.
That was pretty good.
Thank you.
All right, last one on the housing conversation. It's the Make Me Smart question. This one's from Kim Larue.
Hey, Molly and Kai. This is Kim in San Diego, California. I own a home in a lower-income, racially diverse, and business-poor neighborhood. I'm involved in a local garden club with a mission to beautify the area and get people to take pride in their yards and streets. I always thought increased property values were a good idea, but our group has been counseled to never use property values to justify improvements. While people may want shade trees, coffee shops, or bus benches, they don't want their neighborhood to become too nice because they can't afford it when property taxes exceed affordability. I realize now the whole concept of better property values is based on a plan to sell and move up and out. But if you're not planning on leaving, increasing property values is not the best idea. Mind blown. Hey, thanks for all your work and insights.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not all about selling, right? It's about wealth accumulation and housing and real estate as part of that. But I get it.
Yeah. No, I get it. Just the fact that is a mentality that one way to try to protect your neighborhood from this sort of like voracious appetite of housing because there's not enough is to keep it not nice is...
It's a little flawed. Speaking of broken markets.
That's a lot. That's a lot. Yeah. Broken market.
Broken market. All right, that is it for this week's podcast. Sign up for the weekly Make Me Smart newsletter, please. Shows up in your inbox every Friday morning, and it will make you smarter, I promise. Marketplace.org/newsletters, followed closely thereafter by marketplace.org/donate, can I just say?
Donate.
Get a t-shirt.
It's a really nice t-shirt. It's so nice. I mean, I know Kai doesn't wear shirts, but for those of you who do.
You know what I mean.
You'll enjoy it.
I'm not a human mannequin.
Another week goes by the way, with no podcast recommendation list from Kai Rizdahl.
Nobody asked.
Make me smart.
Nobody asked. You had a whole 31 minutes and 54 seconds.
No.
Nobody
it
asked.
Was in the Slack.
Sorry, sister.
Make
we're
me smart.
Done now. The music's rolling. Gotta go.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to Sitar Nieves for stepping in today. Our video producer, Ben Heathcoat. Our video intern, Ethan Peretz. Make the cameras go. And thanks to writer-producer, Eric Phillips.
Also, gotta ask. All right, this week's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Ben Tolliday. Somebody get a hold of him and ask him if his real name is Benjamin, please. Executive Director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The Senior Vice President and General Manager is Deborah Clark, who I'm not sure listens anymore.
You can't email a guy on parental leave.
Of course you can. He's not on parental leave. He's on cool project leave.
Oh, right. Okay. I'm going to text him.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm going to text him right now.
You have his phone
Hang
number?
Hang on.
I don't even have his phone number.
You guys are
what
not homies. We're homies. If there's anybody in the shop you're going to make friends with, all due respect to everybody
JoJo the dog
listening, it's the engineers.
That is true. That's a smart thing to
Kai
do.
Kai and I would like to know... if your full name is Benjamin.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.